Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Financial Services and E-Commerce Practice Group, was recorded on Monday, June 23, 2014, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members.
We are very pleased to welcome to our call today two experts, both with a lot of experience as commissioners on the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission. We're going to hear opening remarks from each, then maybe a little bit of back and forth, and then always, as always, we'll turn to the audience for questions, so please be thinking about those questions in advance. We're going to hear first from Honorable Daniel M. Gallagher. He's a current commissioner on the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission. He's going to speak for 5 to 10 minutes or so, and then we'll hear from the Honorable Paul S. Atkins. He's the CEO of Padamac Global Partners and former commissioner of the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission. And with that, Commissioner Gallagher, the floor is yours.
Thank you very much, Dean. It's a real honor to be on the call. And before I get going, I have to give you my standard disclaimer, as most folks would expect, that my remarks today are my own and don't necessarily reflect the views of the commission or other commissioners, unfortunately. So it's an interesting time at the SEC, as most of you who watch the agency know. We're about a little over 1 year into the tenure of Mary Jo White as the chair of the agency. She started in April of 2013. We also had two commissioners join the agency in August, replacing Elise Walter and Troy Paredes. We have Kara Stein and Michael Pivovar, one Democrat, one Republican, both coming from the Senate Banking Committee. And so there's been a lot of change in 1 year, 60% turnover at the commission, and that's had a real impact, I would say, on the work of the agency. First and foremost, the agenda of the agency. As I like to tell people, the agency is nothing at this point except its agenda. It's all about what we focus on, and that is in large part, or if not completely, because of the impact of the Dodd-Frank Act, which, as many of you know, in next month will be 4 years old, 2,319-page behemoth of a statute, mostly single-party piece of legislation, and which would explain some of its excesses, if not all of them. And within Dodd-Frank, what we have are 400 mandates to federal agencies for rulemakings. And the SEC won the lottery in there, and we got 100 of the 400. So 25% of the rulemakings come to the SEC. That's not necessarily a good thing if you're into turf building and jurisdiction and things like that, which many agencies in Washington are. Those 100 rulemakings do not necessarily mean that the agency got more power and authority. In fact, I would say that in large part, the rulemakings have bogged the agency down, distracted the agency from its traditional work, which includes investor protection, maintaining fair and efficient markets, and facilitating capital formation, and has moved us into more exotic areas of policymaking, including mandated disclosure for public companies of the use of conflict minerals in the Congo. Mandated disclosure by oil, gas, and mining companies of their extractive resources, leases, and contracts with foreign countries. These are areas where I would submit the agency should not be playing, but has unfortunately, because they've been prioritized on the agenda of the agency, spent a lot of time over the last couple years. Time spent while other agencies, including most particularly the Fed, have been using their authority gained in Dodd-Frank, which is an immense grant of power to the banking agencies, the Fed in particular, and they've been marching through their rulemakings one by one, all of which are germane in some ways to the markets they oversee, all of which have increased their footprint into the American economy, most specifically the capital markets. The capital markets, for purposes of today's call, without getting too nuanced, or the non-bank financing markets of the United States. In the U.S., it's where 80% of financing occurs for our economy. 20% occurs in the banking markets. That would be the exact opposite of what you find in Europe, where 80% of financing for the economies in Europe occurs in the banking sector and 20% in the capital markets. That would also explain why the Europeans are so happy to get together at little confabs in Basel, whether it be the Financial Stability Board, the Basel Committee on Banking, or elsewhere, and make up rules that impair the U.S. capital markets, because it's a one-way road for them. So the agency, with these 100 Dodd-Frank rulemakings, you would think 4 years down the road would be largely past the main burden of those tasks set out by Congress. Unfortunately, I can tell you we are less than halfway there. We have approximately, I believe it's 58 of the 100 Dodd-Frank rulemakings remaining at the SEC. I'm personally not upset about that. I think the remaining 58 are for the most part garbage. However, this is an amazing thing for most people to realize. They look and they see that the Volcker rule, which is mostly the rule that people identify with Dodd-Frank, was completed last December 2013. And so I think the general sentiment in the city and elsewhere is that Dodd-Frank is done. Because the Volcker rule is done, Dodd-Frank is done. Well, I can tell you today that that is far from the case, that with 58 mandated Dodd-Frank rulemakings left, many of which are just entirely political and have nothing to do with the agency's mission, that there is much distraction to be had at the commission. There's a push by some on the commission and the outside to get these rulemakings all done before there's further change in Congress and in the White House. As you know, Dodd-Frank has been untouched for the last 4 years. There have been no amendments, even technical ones, to Dodd-Frank, and that's a real problem because on a bipartisan basis, I think most would agree that many changes need to be made, that the statute missed in large part certain issues, and in other areas overreacted and got things wrong, the law of unintended consequences. But it's been inviolate for 4 years, and that's a real problem. And I think, again, there's been an impetus, therefore, by certain groups within the commission and without, to get these rules done before the mandates themselves could be changed. And one last point on Dodd-Frank before I turn it over to Commissioner Atkins here is that it's one thing to have 100 rulemakings. It's another thing if there's 400 within the whole statute. Folks can get lulled into a sense of complacency that all of those rulemakings will not only address the financial crisis that we experienced in 07 and 08, but perhaps stave off the next one, hopefully stave off the next one. That's the intention in many ways of Dodd-Frank. You need only look at its preamble to see that. Well, I will tell you I'm a firm believer, and I'm going to go out on a limb and say Commissioner Atkins agrees that Dodd-Frank is premised on a series of false narratives about the financial crisis, that the financial crisis was due largely because of regulatory failures and Wall Street greed. And while both of those might have featured in some way in the crisis, there is no mention of the true cause of the financial crisis, which is failed federal housing policy. And if you do a word search throughout the 2,319 pages, you will see nothing about Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac or reform thereof. And I think that tells you all you need to know about Dodd-Frank and its political basis. And so while the SEC is distracted, one thing that occurs to me is that we also not only need to worry about the distraction from our main mission, but we all as citizens should be concerned that we've glossed over the causes, the true causes of the financial crisis, and that we'll never get a chance to look at those again. And certain policymakers, I believe, in this town would hope it be that way. So with that, I will turn it over to Commissioner Atkins and get his views.
Okay, well, thank you, Commissioner Gallagher. It's a pleasure to be with you today and to have you all on the telephone as well. And since this is a group of lawyers, I take it, mainly on the telephone, I thought I would get down to talking about some legal provisions of that 2,319-page behemoth that we were talking about, Dodd-Frank. And so there are about 12 titles or so in all in the thing, 15, 16, that's it. So anyway, but a couple of them are very short, but nonetheless pack a wallop when you actually read them. But I wanted to focus on the first title, which is entitled Financial Stability. And that's one of the main conceits, let's say, about Dodd-Frank, is that, you know, in light of what went on in 2008, that regulation and more government control of the markets can make the markets more stable. So one thing that Dodd-Frank set up in Title I is called the Financial Stability Oversight Council. And if you remember back to the days following long-term capital management back in the 1990s and all the problems that came from the Russian market and elsewhere, the White House at the time under the Clinton administration set up what was called the President's Working Group on Financial Markets, which was a good idea. And so it had the Secretary of Treasury on it and the head of, well, really the head of the National Economic Council, who's the President's main economic advisor, and then the heads of the various regulators, the Fed, the SEC, the CFTC, sitting around a table to talk about the financial markets and how to basically the idea of more coordination would make things better in the marketplace. Well, and so I think that was a good idea. They dealt with a lot of different issues of transparency and to make sure that you know, the big banks knew who their counterparties were and who was lending what to whom and what exposure they all had. So now fast forward to the wake of Dodd-Frank in 2010. So the Financial Stability Oversight Council was set up as sort of the President's Working Group on steroids. So there is real authority vested in this group of really 10 voting members who are supposed to sit around a table, think deep thoughts, peer into their crystal balls, and prick financial bubbles before they happen. Now, of course, that's easier said than done. It didn't work very well the last time around when the Fed, you know, you look at some of the Fed open federal, you know, open market committee minutes, and not to say anything bad about the folks there at the time, but, you know, it's just a matter that one cannot foresee everything. And especially, you know, if you're dealing with whatever tools you have to keep a tab on the marketplace. So, so anyway, but the conceit behind Dodd-Frank is that if you get smart people in a room and give them information, that they will be able to foresee everything that goes on and take appropriate action. Friedrich von Hayek wrote a book called Fatal Conceit. It was actually his last book, where he, this is, goes back to the 80s, I guess, late 70s when he wrote it, and basically he lampooned that very idea back there that, you know, that there's just too much information for human beings to process and take appropriate action. So, but notwithstanding all that, you have the FSOC with these regulators sitting around the table, and the statute gives them authority under Section 113 to designate certain financial institutions or to be systemically important, and to then to designate them and regulate them, giving the Fed powers to regulate them, you know, through its capital tools and things like that. So the statute says that banks with greater than $50 billion of assets are automatically these systemically important financial institutions. SIFI, which I think some people mispronounce. So if you have HIFI, which is Hi-Fi, WIFI, Wi-Fi, SIFI, to me is sci-fi, not SIFI. And sci-fi in every sense of that word, including science fiction, which I think is what we're dealing with here. So anyway, so banks above $50 billion are by statute sci-fis automatically. Then the FSOC went on to the next group. They were looking at financial utilities, basically clearinghouses, DTC, and those sorts of things. Named them sci-fis. Then they started turning to insurance companies, and they designated right off GE Capital, AIG, and Pru They say they're looking at MetLife as well. And so now they've trained their eyes on non-bank, non-insurance, another acronym. I haven't come up with a good, maybe somebody has NUBNIs or something, NBNIs, but anyway, those are, they're looking at asset management companies. It's not really clear what they're looking at, whether they're looking at the funds, at the managers, or at the activity. We've heard kind of all three sorts of things coming out of the FSOC and the Treasury and whatnot. But suffice it to say, the asset management companies, unlike these other types of entities, are not leveraged for the most part. They are, especially mutual funds, of course, regulated by the SEC, and they are pretty much all equity as far as looking at it from the perspective of the investor. So right now I really am very much concerned about what's going on that score. And it's not just here in the United States, but it's also abroad, is being replicated globally. There's a group called the Financial Stability Board, which was kind of set up by the G20, sort of, but it's grown out of the Basel Committee on Banking Supervision. And so they have gone on their own route to designate globally systemically significant firms. So they started out with systemically important banks, G-SIBs, then they went to G-SIZE, systemically important insurers. And so now what's next? They're also looking at non-bank NIBNIs, non-bank non-insurance companies. So we see this growing ambit of regulatory scrutiny, and really the question is to what end? And if you're looking at it from the perspective of a mutual fund investor, say, the real question is, what's going to happen? You know, right now it's your fund is heavily regulated by the SEC. You have a separate board. There are rules as to, you know, disclosure and what the what that fund can invest in. But now if we're talking about an extra layer of prudential regulation in the form of capital charges, you know, on whom would those charges, those costs fall? If you're a mutual fund investor and you're putting $100 into your mutual fund, does this mean that if they're going to use the Basel III types of rules, does that mean that up to 12% perhaps of your investment maybe you can't touch? So maybe $12 out of your $100 you can't touch. And how is that going to you know, ripple through the system? What's that mean if they decide to impose, instead of on investors, on the financial managers, you know, investment managers of those investment companies? You know, they don't really have capital at risk. Of course, they're a manager to the fund. So you can see the problems with how we have this system that's set up by Dodd-Frank that's now butting up into the market realities of other things, and where you have regulators who are interested in expanding their ambit of regulatory authority because they see a boogeyman behind every tree. You know, it's going to be, I think, very harmful to the marketplace to have this go forward. So I've spoken enough, but anyway, Dean, wanted to turn it back to you.
All right. Thank you both, Commissioners. Before I revert to Commissioner Gallagher, let me make a brief announcement about our upcoming schedule. We've had a few cases decided today by the U.S. Supreme Court, and we're trying to schedule teleform conference calls on those. So do take a look at the Federal Society website and monitor your emails for changes to our schedule. But as of right now, tomorrow at 4 p.m. is our next scheduled teleform conference call, where we'll be discussing the status of publicly held lands, private property, and states' rights. Then on Thursday at 1 p.m., our teleform call will focus on two IP cases decided a bit earlier this term in the U.S. Supreme Court. But as I mentioned, do monitor our website and your emails for updates to that schedule. Commissioner Gallagher, do you want to respond to anything Commissioner Atkins said or augment your statement?
No, I thought it was brilliant and on point, and I actually agree with almost everything Commissioner Atkins said, with everything. The one thing that I'm glad he hit on that I think I only very lightly touched is that while we have this domestic debate about the proper role of regulation in the financial markets, it's happening against the backdrop of this international debate. Paul mentioned the FSB, the Financial Stability Board. However it was formed, it is now a bricks-and-mortar entity in Basel that sits right down the road from the Bank of International Settlements, which gives us the Basel rules, in the Basel Committee. And it is engaged in activities meant to, when brought to their natural conclusion, impact domestic law here in the United States. And I find that very disturbing as a citizen. I think that the G20 mandates that the FSB is acting on are not treaties. They're just simply statements that diplomats, essentially bureaucrats, issue, sometimes the president, but most of the time are statements issued by bureaucrats that the FSB is working on with the very intent of having those mandates, the rules and the prescriptive requirements that they come up with in Basel trickle down into the rule books of the various federal agencies here in the U.S. And I just one interesting tidbit on that, Dean, is that it happens at the same time as the TTIP negotiations, the treaty negotiations are happening in Europe, and there's a big debate right now about whether TTIP should include within it financial services regulation. And the position of the administration, as carried through by the Treasury Department and State Department, is that financial services regulation should not be part of any treaty with Europe. And I find that fascinating, given that they're treating the G20 mandates as if they're treaties. But of course, as we know, any treaty would require a supermajority vote in the Senate, and they're bypassing that through their G20 edicts. So there's an international angle to this that is undeniable, that it's forceful, and that it's fraught with legal issues that I think most on the call would find pretty interesting.
Now, are those mandates, those G20 mandates, do they purport to be self-executing, or are the federal agencies just taking it upon themselves to implement the mandates of the G20?
Well, it's even more attenuated than that, Dean. The G20 mandates, there's one in particular that stands out to me, was the Pittsburgh mandate from 2009 when the G20 met in Pittsburgh. There was a line in a communique that came out of the G20 meeting that said that the various G20 jurisdictions should get together within the Financial Stability Board, which is the operating arm for financial services regulation of the G20, to come up with global rules to oversee the OTC derivatives markets. And if you look at the rulemakings of the SEC, of the CFTC, and I'm sure elsewhere other regulators have referenced them in their rules, you'll see reference to the G20 mandates as a source of law in this space, which I find not to be persuasive at all. But the agencies themselves, the SEC is a member, a voting member of the FSB, the Fed has a large voice at the FSB, and then it's dominated by central bankers. The capital markets voice, which would be the SEC here, the old FSA in the UK, the AMF in France, these voices, to the extent they're even represented on the FSB, are much outweighed by the central bankers, who have de-risking at the top of their agenda for all of their rules coming out of the FSB and therefore the domestic rules that follow.
That's one thing I wanted to jump into, because I can probably speak more freely on this than can the commissioner, but I really find it very disturbing when you look at the makeup of both FSB and FSOC, like Commissioner Gallagher said, it's mainly bank regulators. So when you look around the table, and for example, when Prue was designated as a SIFI by the FSOC, for whatever reason, Mary Jo White, the chairman of the SEC, recused herself, and so obviously respect that. But because the FSOC is set up as a personal membership devolving onto the various heads of these agencies, when the chairman of the SEC is recused, that means the SEC has no seat at the table. And so I commend to your reading a dissent by the insurance expert, so-called, who is a great guy, Roy Woodall. He's a former state of Kentucky insurance commissioner. But Dodd-Frank sets up a so-called insurance expert that the president appoints, and so Roy Woodall is the president's appointment. appointee for the FSOC, he wrote a blistering, absolutely blistering dissent to the designation of PRU, and he was joined also in the Navote by DeMarco, and so that was the those were the only two, and then SEC, of course, was recused. We don't know how they would have voted or how the chairman of SEC would have voted. But for a designation to have been done by these bank regulators over the objections of the president's appointed insurance expert of an insurance company, I think is really unbelievable, frankly. And so now they're going down the road of thinking about designating asset managers. And so the implications of that, I think, are really huge. And so this, to me, having sat through both as a staffer at the SEC back in the early 90s under Chairman Breeden and Chairman Leavitt, and then as a commissioner, and I don't think this should be viewed as a turf battle by any means, because ultimately we're talking about investors and the markets. But, you know, for better or for worse, the SEC is overseeing the financial markets and presumably knows something about them. And I think that the bank regulators need to defer to them. And there's this sort of Orwellian titled Office of Financial Research, which is not just a research agency, but which is an arm of the FSOC and by extension Treasury. They have subpoena power and they were set up by Dodd-Frank. But they wrote a really sophomoric report back in September of last year where they talked about designation of asset managers as sci-fis or potentially as sci-fis, sort of setting the groundwork. But it was riddled with inaccuracies. It was, like I said, it was really, I think my college-age son could have done a better research paper than these people put out. And so, you know, I think that's pretty disturbing that that's informing potential rulemaking. But anyway, it's been roundly attacked by all and sundry. It hasn't been, withdrawn or anything, but it really sets up, questioning of, do these people know what they're doing? And when you look at the motivation statutorily of bank regulators, it's all about safety and soundness. So it's all about things need to be kept quiet and behind closed doors and not, definitely not out in the sunshine. So you're seeing how the FSOC works, you see how the bank regulators work. It's pretty antithetical to the way, at least ideally, the SEC should work and the way the, I think would be good for the financial markets. So with that,
I agree.
Thanks.
Any reaction to that, Commissioner Gallagher, or you want to turn to the audience for questions?
Well, it's hard not to react. I think that Paul made a bunch of really good, insightful comments about the FSOC, and as he pointed out in his introductory remarks, when you get the sci-fi designation, I'm going to try my best to put sci-fi and not SIFI. Sounds less like a venereal disease when you say
sci-fi. That's probably
yeah. So with the sci-fi designation comes bank regulation, and so now you have certain insurance companies either designated as sci-fis or soon to be designated, as the plan may be, potentially asset managers being designated as sci-fis. And, one way to look at it, as Paul said, is that this brings with it the bank regulatory paradigm and the mindset that we need to de-risk everything, that will operate in the opaqueness of the banking regulator model, which is, antithetical to the SEC process, or as Paul said, should be, and I agree, where we operate in a fully transparent way, or should at least. We're overseen by Congress, between Congress, the IG, and FOIA requests, everything is pretty much open, and there aren't many statutory protections for information at the SEC as compared to the bank regulators. It's a movement towards bank-like regulation for entities that are not at all like banks to de-risk them. But at the same time, you could take a really more sinister view of this whole thing and say that it's another attempt by the federal government to control large swaths of the American economy that aren't controlled directly right now, where the FSOC chairman, which is the Treasury Secretary, which is a cabinet member of the president's administration, is making determinations about treating non-banks like banks And as we've all seen, unfortunately, where you have the big banks being overseen by the Fed and the OCC, they are not exactly open and pushing back on regulation and resisting intrusions by the government, because in many ways they've become an arm of the government, that the too big to fail moniker has helped them in their business in some ways, but that at the same time they realize that they cannot forcefully resist the government. And why wouldn't a Treasury Secretary who wants more central command want to designate more institutions?
There's also another, I mean, that, now that you raised the aspect of a sinister view, I mean, if you were a real conspiracy theorist, you could look at this rush to try to designate other sorts of institutions as trying to expand the ambit of bailouts and the whole too big to fail aspect, and basically making, for investors, TARPs are us, because Section 210(o) of Dodd-Frank, so you all can go look that one up, but basically gives power for for the government to look at these designated institutions, these sci-fis, and have them pony up for the bailout fund that may be there in case of another financial crisis.
Well, why don't we check in with the audience, see what's on their minds. In a moment, we'll all hear an announcement that will say the floor mode is on. After that, if you're in the audience, if you have a question for either of our experts, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. So once again, if you have a question for either of our experts, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. We've got one caller, then our lines are open. Let's go to our first question of the day.
John Rowland, Constitution.org. Perhaps we could have a discussion of the underlying legal constitutional theory of all of these things. The jurisdiction of the federal regulators to regulate banks seems to be based, at least in theory, on their voluntary membership in the FDIC and other protections of that sort. In other words, contractual. There's some talk about using the Commerce Clause, but that was Commerce originally meant only tangible commodities, not services and not financial instruments. Then there's the bankruptcy clause that could in principle be used to force institutions into bankruptcy before they actually became insolvent if they could be expected to become insolvent in the foreseeable future, and in that capacity present a threat to the public good. So how do you sort out all these legal theories in this discussion?
Yeah.
So I'll take a stab. This is Dan Gallagher, real fast. It's a great question, and I think that we've seen various aspects of Dodd-Frank challenged in court. They generally... this is outside of this whole sci-fi designation process, which I know is the core of your question. We at the commission were sued on the conflict minerals disclosure requirement of Section 1502 of Dodd-Frank. We were sued also on Section 1504 rulemaking that we did on extractive resources. And in both of those lawsuits, there were constitutional claims made. They were actually First Amendment claims, where in the first, the 1504 decision, which came first from the D.C. District Court, which vacated the rule, they never even touched the First Amendment issue because they didn't need to get there. They found that the agency acted arbitrarily and capriciously in its definitional rulemaking and could have imposed a much less burdensome rule or should have looked at other alternatives. In the recent conflict minerals decision that we got out of the D.C. Circuit, the D.C. Circuit panel there took up the First Amendment issue and found that the disclosure piece of the commission's rulemaking, whereby companies would have to say whether or not that they were using conflict minerals from the Congo, was actually possibly, potentially in violation of the First Amendment, and therefore left that piece of the rulemaking vacated. So in those instances, we saw constitutional challenges. One was taken up, one was not. There's still some posturing going on in the D.C. Circuit, pending decisions in other cases to see where that First Amendment issue goes, but that's going to be an important one to watch. On the designation issue, though, again, that's core to your question, I don't believe yet that there's been a legal challenge on a designation. There was some saber rattling going on by one of the insurance companies. There were three insurance companies that have been talked about as being designated. Prue, obviously, has already happened, I believe. MetLife was another one. And there's been a lot of talk about whether one of those insurance companies would invoke the so-called process appeals provisions of Title I to challenge the designation. And it just hasn't played out yet. But I think that the constitutional issues you raise would come to bear in those challenges. And I don't know what they would invoke, by way of in an appeal, what the constitutional challenge would be. I don't know what the defense by the FSOC would be, because they have not tied those provisions, as far as I know it, in Title I of Dodd-Frank to any particular constitutional grant of authority. My guess is it would be the Commerce Clause, but I don't know. I don't know if Drakens has thought about that.
Well, there are a few constitutional challenges already that have been lodged with respect to Dodd-Frank, and one is by the State National Bank of Big Spring, Texas, the Competitive Enterprise Institute, and some others, and so they're challenging Title, the FSOC title, which is Title I, of course, the resolution authority, which is, pretty breathtaking when you look at Title II, and then the title with respect to the CFPB. So those, it's under a number of different clauses, appointments, due process, and whatnot. And so, especially with the designation process, there are, in Title I, there are, many things there to attack, including, for example, the whole process as such of designation has a provision basically at the end of Section 113 that basically restricts the ambit of the judiciary in reviewing these designations from, basically taking substantive review off the table on the merits and just looking at the procedure, whether or not it was done in an arbitrary and capricious way. So, and then of course, the president's hands are tied with respect to whom he can appoint to the FSOC and their authority, and then with Title II, of course, the FDIC and other parts of the regulatory structure have pretty breathtaking grants of authority to redo agreements, almost like if you remember what happened with respect to the General Motors and Chrysler bondholders and others in those bankruptcies. Basically, this sort of authority is now etched in stone in Dodd-Frank. And then, of course, the CFPB has all sorts of issues with respect to its funding, with appointment of the head of the agency. And so this gets down to whether or not these officers of the United States and those sorts of issues. So suffice it to say that there are many constitutional issues that are involved here with Dodd-Frank, and there are lawsuits underway. And I'm sure if you all on the phone want to get involved with that, people would be more than happy to talk to you about it.
If you'd like to join the conversation today, you need to push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Our lines are wide open. Let me ask a follow-up question there while we're waiting to see who else might ring in. In terms of the SEC's larger record in litigation, and at least recently, it seems to have suffered a string of defeats in the D.C. Circuit Court. I wonder if either of you want to talk about any of those cases, or what some of those losses might mean, if there's a theme emerging there. I think some of those cases weren't. The SEC did not seek cert to the U.S. Supreme Court. Any comment on those cases?
All right. Well, it's Dan Gallagher. I'll start, and I think it's a great question, Dean, because we have an interesting bit of continuity in history between the two of us here on these issues, because at base, what you've seen is that except for maybe one, I think the rulemakings that have been challenged in the D.C. Circuit have been what I call non-unanimous votes, which has been a relatively recent trend of the commission the last 10, 15 years. You've seen a number of split votes, whether they be 4-1 or more likely 3-2. Those seem to be the ones that are more contentious and the ones that the infirmities of which have been exposed through dissent of the dissenting commissioner, such that I believe it's inspired litigants to appeal the rules. At last count, and I'll look and my counsel will tell me if I'm getting it wrong, I think we have about 8 rulemakings where either the D.C. District Court, which is interesting, we've been taking appeals at least initially of our rulemakings at the D.C. District Court under Dodd-Frank, but generally between the D.C. District Court and the D.C. Circuit, there have been 8 rules that have been vacated, at least in part, since 2005, I believe, since the first lawsuit, of the recent spate, the first one was filed in 2005. This, to your point, Dean, has really caused a lot of trauma for the agency. I would say for federal agencies generally, but really for the SEC and perhaps the CFTC, these stinging losses have caused some introspection. I think the last one, which was the proxy access rulemaking of August of 2011, I believe that decision came out, which was a stinging rebuke of the agency's proxy access rulemaking. And the basis of the decision was that the agency acted in an arbitrary and capricious manner because we did not conduct an economic analysis, a cost-benefit analysis of the rulemaking as it proceeded, and in fact just arrived at the conclusion and justified it later. And the language of that opinion I would commend to everyone on the phone who hasn't read it, because it was very strong. It caused the agency in the first quarter of 2012 to put together at a staff level between the general counsel's office and the economists a memorandum regarding economic analysis and rulemakings, which is public and on our website. I believe it's March of 2012. And this is a new paradigm of rulemaking for the commission, which mandates that the economists be involved at the very beginning stages of the rulemaking, that alternatives be considered in any rulemaking that might be less burdensome, and that they be explained in the rulemakings. And in a nutshell, would, if properly instituted, create a more robust rulemaking process than the agency had traditionally engaged in. I think it's working out for the better. It's still not perfect, don't get me wrong, but I do think that memo has had a big impact on our rulemaking processes. If nothing else, I think the decision-making is more transparent as you read the releases, if you have time to read multi-hundred-page releases, which it seems we don't do anything under 500 pages these days. But that memo and this new way of thinking about economic analysis, and quite frankly, the growth of the economics function within the agency, I think, are all tied to those litigations. So there's one direct and sort of operational, real-world impact of these decisions. I'll turn it over to you.
I wanted to echo that. When you look at the work that Craig Lewis in particular did in the wake of that, like the commissioner said, the stinging rebuke there of proxy access. So there was an example of a rulemaking that the SEC has been kicking around for more than 40 years, maybe even 50 years, right? And it's never even, that has never gone ahead. It finally did. That was the former chairman's, first thing out of the box. The ink was not even dry on Dodd-Frank. When she pushed it out the door, in a very, you know, half-baked way, frankly, and the SEC got its head handed to it in the court. And so there are a number of people who have been gnashing their teeth saying, oh my gosh, the agency's hands are so tied over rulemaking, you know, this is just set such a high bar. But when you actually look at the opinions of D.C. Circuit in that one, the proxy access one, and then going back to when I was a commissioner for with respect to the mutual fund independent chairman rule, basically the circuit said you've just got to at least do something that passes the red face test. You have to at least do an economic analysis and kind of weigh both sides. And in these particular instances, the SEC didn't even bother to do it. Lawyers were the ones who wrote the economic, so-called economic analysis. It was always very much of an ends-oriented type of thing. After everything else was done, then they did it just as a way to kind of paper over the requirement. And so I think Craig Lewis basically took a good a view of this and try to at least live up to what the statute and the law requires. So I think, like the commissioner said, maybe there's hopefully some good that will come out of this, and that the agencies will actually look to see what the economic ramifications of their rules are, and they're just not dreaming things up and then trying to push them forward.
And I'd be remiss if I didn't weigh in and say, you know, as much as large groups don't like SEC rulemakings or CFTC rulemakings, at least you do have this type of redress. You usually have some sort of impacted party who will have the wherewithal and the moxie to go to the D.C. District Court or the Circuit Court and challenge. Where you don't see this is in bank regulator rules, where the affected parties are much more captive. You don't see this type of litigation, and it's the view, at least I believe at the Fed, that they are not subject to any mandate to conduct an economic analysis of the rulemaking.
Yeah.
This was a big issue. This is a great legal point. This was a big issue in the so-called Volcker rulemaking, as I mentioned earlier, that happened in December. It was mandated by Dodd-Frank. It was a joint rulemaking with about five agencies, the bank regulators, the CFTC, and the SEC. And because the SEC views that we have a mandate to undergo an economic analysis in our rulemaking, and that mandate derives from various portions of the statutes that we administer, the decision was made at the FSOC level, I believe by the Treasury Secretary, and then carried out by the constituent members who had this mandate given to them in Dodd-Frank, that the rule would be promulgated under the Bank Holding Company Act and not under any of the organic statutes that the commission administers, because that way they could get away from conducting an economic analysis. So talk about a perversion of the normal processes. The SEC engaged in a rulemaking under a statute in which we generally have no authority, and which raises the related enforcement question about how we would enforce the rule that we promulgated in the Bank Holding Company Act.
That's a good point. And the and it's true. So going back to this constitutional challenge with respect to Dodd-Frank, as I mentioned, it's one of the plaintiffs is a state national bank in Big Spring, Texas. So there you have a case of a bank, a small bank, albeit, but one that's still subject to the statute and challenging things. So it's on the banking side, it is very dangerous. And I was also, I failed to mention that similarly to the Affordable Care Act, there are 11 states that have joined that lawsuit with respect to Dodd-Frank that the State National Bank Big Spring has lodged. So there are, you know, a lot of parties there. But I think this goes back to your point that it is difficult for many regulated entities to sue their regulator, and especially when you have a prudential regulatory structure where a regulator can yank your charter without really any due process, done behind closed doors, and shut you down, whereas that's not so likely to happen regulatory.
All right, let's take another question from our audience. We've got one question pending, then our lines are open. If you'd like to ask a question, you need to push the star button and the pound button on your telephone. Let's go to our next caller.
Hi, this is Hester Peirce from the Mercatus Center. The SEC just turned 80 this month, so on the positive front, what would be the most important objective for the SEC during its next decade?
Well, hello, Hester. This is Dan Gallagher responding. I think it's great. I saw your piece that you put out on this issue, and I thought it was terrific. I do think it's important for the agency to focus on, quite frankly, existential issues of what is this agency, what's it meant to do, should it continue to exist? I think a lot of people think that the agency serves an important role for investors. I would agree. I think it's important that the agency be an advocate for the markets it oversees, the capital markets, and how important that is not only to the economy, but to investors who, especially in a 0% interest rate environment, need to find some yield in order to survive. And right now, unfortunately, for the last several years, the agency has been too busy being the scribe of Congress, implementing in many instances nonsensical statutory mandates instead of hewing to its original mission and trying to improve the way it conducts that original mission of investor protection, fair and efficient markets, and capital formation. And so I think that as the agency turns 80, you raise a good point, which is at base, the agency needs to be thinking about what its role is going forward. Dodd-Frank, as you know, Hester, purported to, as one of its goals, clarify and consolidate the alphabet soup of agencies in Washington. And as those who watch closely like us know, they got rid of one agency, the OTS, and they added at least three, depending on how you count. And so we actually ended up, post-Dodd-Frank, with a more jumbled regulatory system than we had before the statute and before the crisis. And I don't think that's good for anyone. Too many layers of overlapping government oversight, particularly within the federal government itself. This is outside of the state system, which we have chosen in many ways not to rely on, oftentimes to our detriment, is a bad thing for markets, is a bad thing for investors. And I think the agency, the SEC, needs to figure out what role it's going to play within that constellation of regulators. Some have said recently that we should be a systemic risk regulator, and that's an interesting thought. I personally believe that if we're good at our core mission, then that's good for the system, without having to be some sort of uber prudential systemic regulator. That really isn't what we are equipped to do at the SEC. But if we're doing our job, if we're protecting investors and making the markets more fair and promoting capital formation for small businesses, for investors, I think that that's all good for the system. And so I don't think converting us, the agency, into a systemic regulator makes much sense. So I'll leave that debate for others. I don't know if you have any thoughts, Paul, about turning 80 and what the agency needs to think about.
Well, I think, the pig through the python analogy that I remember Commissioner Grenfest used to talk about, but here we have the old Dodd-Frank rulemaking going through, and SEC needs to think about what is coming ahead and how these various rulemakings will play out, not only in what its mission is, but how it will affect the markets. And just looking at some of the current debate regarding market structure, and when you talk about, I think, in this case, intended consequences, frankly, of Reg NMS, which I voted against back in 2005, and I would vote against it again today. But the whole idea of a command and control type of situation, expanding the ability for the SEC staff behind closed doors to influence the way the markets work, I think a lot of the issues that we have in today's marketplace go right back to that particular regulation. But I think the SEC needs to think about where the United States markets are and where they're going. Competitiveness of the United States markets, that issue has not gone away, notwithstanding the financial crisis. We need to be inviting investors to come here and encouraging them to come and invest in the United States. So sure, part of that is a rule of law, predictability, and certainty, enforceability of contract, those sorts of things that make the U.S. such a great place to invest. But as we get away from that, and we see that on the enforcement side, where it seems to be less and less rule of law and more of the rule of the jungle, frankly. And I worry constantly on another side with respect to this artificial zero interest rate environment and the financial repression that we're seeing from the market regulators, the monetary regulators at the Fed and elsewhere, where we have a really precarious situation for savers and investors, where they are, cannot rely on fixed income as they used to, and they are basically susceptible to all sorts of schemes, get-rich-quick schemes, and other things, because their basic tried-and-true sources of income in their retirement are not living up to what they had planned. So that's what I really fear, and I think the SEC needs to pay attention to that as well.
We are just about out of time here, but I want to give each of you a chance to wrap up or express any final thoughts you might have. And let's start off in the order let's end in the order we started off. Commissioner Gallagher, final thought here.
Yeah, look, I think we, despite spending some good time here, only scratched the surface of all of these issues. We could talk on any one of those issues for hours, and I wish we could, but in a nutshell, I do think it's a very important time for the SEC. I think that it's an important time for the American economy. I think as the Dodd-Frank rules roll out, as the bank regulators have been empowered in this country in a way that we've never seen before, despite their many failures going into the crisis, which match or I would argue exceed those of the SEC and other regulators, they walked away with more authority. I think we're marching down a dangerous road, which is a road towards, as Commissioner Atkins said earlier, bailouts are us, institutionalizing the role of the federal government in our markets in such a way that entities and products cannot fail. And I find that very disheartening and discouraging as a citizen. I think we should all want, as part of the American spirit of entrepreneurism and generally our willingness to take risks, and reap rewards, we should want a system that rewards hard work, good ideas, but that punishes failures through literally letting institutions and the products they might offer fail. And we've gotten further and further away from that the last several years because of this mindset, which is led by bank regulators, of de-risking has pervaded throughout the rule books, throughout the policy debates. I think it's something that all of us should worry about and continually watch and resist where we can.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more, and I think that's the real lesson that comes out of Dodd-Frank. And it's going to take a while to really work to try to make that Dodd-Frank. It's going to be difficult to obviously repeal it. Governor Romney, when he was running, talked about that, and so I view that as a tough thing. It's entitled the Wall Street Reform and Consumer Protection Act of 2010, and I think the drafters chose that title, with reason, because it's difficult to sell something that would repeal a statute that purports to do that. But I think we'll have to take it page by page, all 2,319 pages of them, and figure out how to make it better, and either it'll hopefully collapse under constitutional challenge or otherwise. But I think that's the real challenge that we face.
Well, gentlemen, this is Dean Reuter again. I want to thank you both for joining us today. I think we have just scratched the surface on this, what is an unfolding, evolving story, and hopefully we'll have you both back at some time in the future to give us an update as we progress through this story. To our audience, I want to thank our audience as well for dialing in and for participating. A reminder that our next scheduled Teleform conference call is tomorrow at 4 p.m. We'll be talking about publicly held lands and states' rights. It looks like we're going to schedule a conference call on Wednesday to discuss today's greenhouse gas decision. But until our next Teleform conference call, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.